Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey, and I think we should make a point of this, that no one knows better about getting us connected and signed up than you do. And did you know, of course you know, this is radio show number 451. Yes, on the Blog Talk Radio site, there are 450 one-hour shows stored that you can see. And I think you can also find them on that podcastdirectory.com. But anyway, take a month or two off from work and listen to all 450 shows, right? Yeah. But welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network. And keep in mind that I talked to somebody yesterday that want to get a show. He said, boy, how do you do that? I said, well, what do? You go to blogtalkradio.com and sign up in less than 10 minutes, and you can be broadcasting worldwide. So anyway, the purpose of this show is always the same. We look at news, issues, events. Boy, is there a lot of news. I mean, it's a plethora of stuff going on relative to criminal justice. And we can't cover it all, of course. But, you know, if you go to Google News or if you go to First Headlines, 1stheadlines.com, that's an incredible site. It covers all the states, all the countries of the world. It updates like every 14 minutes, 10 minutes, 4 minutes sometimes on stories. So anyway, that's an incredible place to go. But we dedicate the show to our tireless and energetic police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who take care of us throughout the United States and around the world. We try to look inside the lives of these CJ professionals, and we take a look at their practice. And some have actually told me in the past that, guess what, they get kind of interested in a particular kind of criminal justice because they heard about it on the show, not just some class that I was teaching someplace. But anyway, this is leading edge technology, and just keep in mind, any person, interest group, can have their own show, broadcasting, streaming audio worldwide, and it doesn't cost you nothing unless it's 14 hours a week, unless you're on that prime time 7 to 9 or 10 or something like that. I'm a prime time normally, but I think this is still prime time. We're a couple hours early tonight. So anyway, we're all set to do this, and you saw what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to be looking at an incredible story. We're going to be taking a look at, guess what, private prisons. we live in a capitalist society, don't we? Sure we do. We have public schools, we have private schools, we have public health services, we have private health services, and on and on and on. And we do the same with prisons and confinement centers. So tonight, it's a very debatable topic, actually. And we're going to find some people on our panel, and you can read about them on our website, but we'll talk about them. They'll get introduced. And, you know, you kind of get the impression they're not for private prisons. And it's, you know, I don't know. I think we need private prisons. In some ways, they're cheaper in a very limited number of ways. They may actually offer a better service. But anyway, and of course, public corrections people generally, that's an overstatement, but they often don't like them because they're what? Taking their jobs and the expanding of their jobs in the public prison system in some state or the federal prison. So anyway, we'll look at this tonight and see what we're doing. Let's start off with news like we usually do. Boy, there's a bunch of stuff going on tonight. Ohio finally executed a man yesterday, and this guy was 45 years old, Mr. Ott or Ottie, it's O-T-T-E, Gary Ott. He was executed at 10:54 a.m., and no, that was today, I'm sorry, that was today he was executed, and his statement at the time of execution, he was singing a hymn, he quoted the Bible, he says, God is good at all times, he says, I'm sorry. But what he did when he was 20 years old, he's 45 now. What he did when he was 20 years old was kill two different people. Isn't that interesting? The victims' families were actually there, and but he was 20 when he killed two different people, a daughter and brother of Wasikowski, and her sister-in-law, brother-in-law, and niece of Kostura. But the killing of Robert Wasikowski and Sharon Kostura. And this was 25 or 20 years ago. Can you believe that? That this man was on death row for 20 years? Obviously, that's not Oklahoma or Texas. The death penalty's got 8 major points of argument about it. Many people think, well, you know, Haley, you'd be for the death penalty. Generally, I'm not. And one of the reasons is, which I bring up with a lot of people don't, I don't want people to do something that I wouldn't do to execute someone, no matter how terrible the crime they committed, to execute someone who has no means of resistance. In other words, you know, whatever. So anyway, I've changed my mind on that. How many times, Audrey? Once or twice, but that's my view about it. But there are other, you know, one is justice. The people deserve that. But if he was in Texas, Oklahoma, this man would be gone in less than a year in Oklahoma, and he'd be gone less than 2 years probably in Texas, and they covered all his appeals and all that stuff. So anyway, he had lots of lawyers, whatever. Okay, speaking of this kind of thing, Governor Rod Blagojevich, he opened up. Remember, he's the Illinois governor that went to prison. He tried to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat and was impeached for multiple corruption charges. By the way, they never did find any money that actually was transferred to him. So anyway, but he talks about his life in prison. And he's a diehard Cubs fan, of course. He better be, right? But he's in federal prison in Denver, Colorado. He's made lots of close friends in prison. And he is very, very dedicated. And guess what he spends his time doing? Teaching the Bible and teaching American history to other prisoners in the prison system. He has a very good sense of humor. He was very likable. Republicans and Democrats before he went to prison really liked Blagojevich, Rod Blagojevich, former Illinois governor. And interesting that he spent all this time. I think he's got like 10 more years to do, if I'm not mistaken. Is that in there somewhere, Audrey? Yeah, he's sentenced to 14 years in prison. And he's got a few more years to do. They might actually let him out early, but because he's a politician, they probably won't. How about this one? A government backlog of 700,000 security clearance reviews has led our federal agents, such as the Defense Department, yes, I said 700,000, to inadvertently issue interim passes, in other words, interim security clearances, until the real one is completed, to even rapists and killers, fueling calls for better and faster vetting of people who have access to the nation's secrets. Can you believe that? These people, it's taken them 9 and 10 months to get like a top secret clearance. I had a top secret clearance once. I won't go into that, way back in the Marine Corps and top secret communications. But anyway, can you believe that we're behind 700,000 security clearances? I mean, it's almost incredible, isn't it? Let me look at this one. Overdose, every state probably has this story. Maybe not every state, but an average in the state of Ohio, 11 people died each day of drug overdoses in Ohio in 2015. A record 4,050 people died of drug overdoses in 2016, with fatalities driven in large part by the emergence of stronger drugs such as synthetic painkillers, fentanyl, and overdose deaths rose 33% over the 3,050 deaths in 2015. 3,050 to 4,050. Can you believe it? And of course, you know, we got the opioids. I mean, they're all over the place. And you got communities giving all kinds of agencies, like schools and churches and police and all kinds of giving them this drug to treat, Narcan or whatever it's called, Narcan, to treat people. And some communities are refusing that. They say, hey, that isn't our job. Remember, I think that was the Middletown or the Butler County Sheriff in Ohio that says this isn't our job to do this. But how stupid can people get to take this stuff when they know they're on the edge of dying from it and they're still doing it? What about this story? Wow. Cleveland police say that three employees of a Cleveland fast food restaurant opened fire on two armed robbers and killing one of them. The two masked robbers entered a Taco Bell on Wednesday last week and ordered employees to the ground. We say three employees pulled out their guns and hitting one of the robbers six times. The other ran away. Investigators said the man who was shot was found with a loaded gun in his hand. He was taken to a hospital and he was pronounced dead. The employees who opened fire were described as a 23-year-old man and two 19-year-old men. Police have not released their names. There's probably an update on that story. I haven't checked today, but that was Taco Bell employees. Can you believe that? When you know who would be very disappointed at that, that would be the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms. Let's listen to what they have to say.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
It might not be a deadly idea for the people who save their lives using those firearms at the Taco Bell. We'll have to see what happens in that. Here's one that is just incredible. I worked 5 years in Plano, Texas, America's wealthy city. I think it still is, or at least it was in the last several years. It's an incredible place, Plano, Texas. 9 people, including a suspect who was fatally shot by an officer, have died after a man opened fire during a gathering to watch football at a suburban Dallas home. And Plano is a wonderful place. The police chief, Greg Lucian, said at a Monday afternoon news conference, one of two people hospitalized, for the Sunday night shooting had died. An officer responded to reported shots fired at 8 p.m. And then he confronted the suspected shooter and opened fire, killing the suspect. Police then found the 9 gunshot victims. 7 were dead, and 2 were taken to the hospital. Isn't that incredible? Whatever happened to a nice friendly game to watch, I assume, the Dallas Cowboys, or watch somebody down there that's familiar, but that would be Plano is probably about as low as you can get for crime rates. It's an incredible place. Average income is, you know, off the page. But anyway, I worked there for 5 years. It's a great, great place. And I'm sorry that something like that happens there. Did you know that somebody has now discovered that too much time spent in a chair could shorten our lives, even if we exercise? They're saying if you stand up more and maybe even walk around a little bit, take steps every half hour or so, that you're going to live longer. How about that? You know, they must have checked. Who was it that wrote that book, Audrey, called Watch TV and Get Fit Too? Watch TV, television, and Get Fit Too. I can't. Oh, wait a minute. That's my book. I give you 10 exercises. You can never miss a second of television and still exercise and get fit also. So anyway, check that book out. It's very inexpensive. Kinds of things you already know, but you never put them together and figured out you could have a health plan by watching television. Okay, obesity rates in the military, have you heard about that? Americans continue to get fatter, and it's delivering a huge blow to the country, both in higher health costs and undercutting our military recruiting. The 14th Annual State of Obesity, Better Policies for a Healthier America, report from the Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Foundation, they found out that this obesity rate is just, it's crazy. And while the rate of obesity growth is leveling off, the costs aren't. The report, for example, said additional health care for obese students and children is $150 billion a year and billions more in lost worker productivity. I won't go on, but it goes on and on and on. The obesity in every state, they found that West Virginia is at the top. 37.7% of people in West Virginia are, I guess we could say, fat. Can we say that, Audrey? Yeah. In West Virginia language, you could. And Colorado's at the bottom with 22%. What are they doing out? Running around the mountains or what? But anyway, isn't that incredible? hey, here's something I wanted to check out with you. Security clearances. We got that down. Truck driving, yeah. Truck driving jobs, I'm not even going to read the article. I've talked about it before. They're available everywhere. And something I discovered about 3 days ago, I think it was on the Drudge News website. It was about the Iowa 88 truck stop. Have you heard about that place? Iowa 88. Just Google that, Iowa 88 truck stop. And in fact, I think it's iowa88.com, but Google it. This truck stop is unbelievable. It has its own mall. It has restaurants, in plural. It has a museum. It has a dental office. Yes, I'm not kidding. It has a dental office. It has a workout studio. What else is going on in that that truck stop? Chiropractor, that's right, because you're driving a long time, you know, your back may hurt, that type of thing. But this place is really class. You look at that, you'll see a beautiful, I mean, they had interior designers that knew what they were really doing. And people travel to this place who don't even truck. A lot of them are just visitors. They've heard about the Iowa 88 truck stop, and they want you to come in. Come on in and take a look and see what this place is like. But it's the Iowa 88 truck stop. They have music special. Unbelievable. So what a place. If I ever go across Iowa 88, I'm going to stop in the Iowa 88 truck stop. Okay, let's take a look at some funny things here. We always do a blonde joke, right? I think we do. Yeah, sure we do. This is an interesting blonde joke. a blonde heard that accidents happened close to home. You know, so you know what she did? She moved. Accidents close to home, so she says, I'm going to move and get away from those things. This is another funny little thing I think you might enjoy. I might not read all of them, but it's, let me see if I can find it. It's up here somewhere. Jobs I didn't take. Jobs. Stay with me. It's coming. Somewhere. Where it be? Mattress sales, jobs I didn't take. We may have to do this next week. Oh, there it is. Jobs I tried, sent to me from a friend in Florida. My first job was working in an orange juice factory, but I got canned. I just couldn't concentrate. Number two, then I worked in the woods as a lumberjack, but I just couldn't hack it, so they gave me the axe. After that, I tried being a tailor, but I wasn't suited for it, mainly because it was a so-so job. Next, I worked at Starbucks, but I had to quit because I got tired of the same old grind. Then I tried being a chef. I figured it would add spice to my life, but I just didn't have the time. Next, I tried working in a deli. But anyway, I sliced it. I just couldn't cut the mustard. My best job was as a musician, but I eventually found out that I wasn't noteworthy. I studied for a long time to become a doctor, but I didn't have the patience. Next was a job in a shoe factory. I tried hard, but I just couldn't fit in. After that, I became a fisherman, but I discovered I couldn't live on my net income. So after that, I got a job at a workout center, but they said I wasn't fit for the job. After many years of trying to find a steady job, I finally got a job as a historian, but then I realized there was no future in it. My last job was when I tried working in a muffler factory, but that was so exhausting. So what did I do? I tried retirement. Okay, that's enough for that thing. We do have a green tip for tonight. Do you know what that is? A green tip? Yes. Go digital instead of taking all those photos and wasting all that paper. So you need to go digital instead of wasting all of that paper. Okay? That's not too good a one, but anyway, in fact, put the doggone phone down. That's really becoming an issue. The news is filled with stories this week about this phone addiction, and I've sensed it when I'm teaching people. Just they can't put this stupid thing down. In fact, I think I have one in my hands, don't I, Audrey? But you've seen them. You know what I'm talking about. I saw one stopped in traffic. Two of them stopped. Both of them texting. And I just waited to see. I was going to make a left turn onto the same street. And these people sat there and sat there and sat there at least 30 seconds. So finally, I beat my horn. I was tired of looking at them. And they, oh, yeah, it's time to drive forward. Absolutely insane, isn't it? Unbelievable. Okay, so go ahead and set up for tonight. And what we're going to do is we're going to listen to some folks talk about private prisons, and you'll hear the people, the panelists, talk about private and public prisons and their impact on incarceration in society. And Mother Jones sent a reporter, Shane Bauer, who was part of the panel discussion, to Louisiana as a prison guard to investigate a corporate-run prison. Joining him on the panel were former San Quentin State Prison Warden Gene Woodford and Marshall Project Director Alcia Santo. And I think you'll enjoy this, so listen up. It's about an hour and 13 minutes. Of course, we won't be able to hear all that, but you'll be able to hear a lot of it. And prisons, you've heard Haley talk about it many times. We have tried every kind of rehabilitation program you can do. Do some work? Yes. But we keep giving people probation and extended probation and another probation and put them under some type of rehab program. And guess what? The recidivism rate, it just end up eventually going to prison. But I know one thing for sure, having done research in a lot of these areas in criminal justice, that when you're behind bars, you cannot rape someone, rob someone, steal drugs, beat people up, shoplift. You can't do it. Now, does some of these prisons mess up a little bit and don't have good security? It happens once in a while. But that's the thing. So anyway, I think you'll enjoy this. Give me time to get it set up, and let's listen to this discussion about prisons.
A look at how private prisons operate. This discussion includes a former warden from a California state prison and a reporter who worked as a private prison guard as part of an investigative story for Mother Jones magazine. From the Commonwealth Club of California, this is an hour and 15 minutes.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Mina Kim. I am a KQED News anchor and also the Friday host of Forum, and I'm also really glad that Marissa is not my editor. If I had to keep my questions to 15 words, my God. Well, welcome to tonight's program within Forum at the Commonwealth Club. Tonight's program tackles the question surrounding for-profit punishment and whether private prisons help or harm the functioning of our criminal justice system. And this is an important question because private prisons have been making a comeback under President Trump. They're poised to grow as well under his sort of law and order approach to things and also his immigration policies. Already in February, the Trump administration reversed last year's Obama administration directive to phase out privately run federal prisons. And stock prices for the two biggest private prison companies have just about doubled since Election Day. Those companies are the
Are you sensing a perspective on this issue?
Geo Group and CoreCivic. CoreCivic is formerly Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA. We have a really incredible panel joining us tonight. Shane Bauer, to my right, is a senior reporter for Mother Jones. He spent 4 months as a private prison guard and brought us a firsthand account of what happens in these prisons. He's also the author of Sliver of Light about his imprisonment in Iran. Welcome, Shane Bauer. And next to Shane is Jeannie Woodford, former warden of San Quentin State Prison. She's also former undersecretary at California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation and a strong opponent of the death penalty. Jeannie Woodford, thanks for coming. Thank you. And Alicia Santo, she flew in from New York for this. She's an investigative journalist for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. She recently wrote an extensive piece on the business of private prison transport and some of the horrific, literally horrific conditions that people face as they're being driven thousands of miles on private vans or buses. So please, thanks for coming, Alicia Santo, all the way from New York for this. I want to start by giving the audience some context, Alicia Santo, of the U.S. private prison population. So the total prison population is about 2 million, is that right? So what proportion of that is private prisoners?
So the 2 million, that includes people in jail, so that's about 600,000 people. Not including the jail population, you have about 1.5 million people who are either in state or federal prison. And out of those, there's 126,000 or so, based on 2015 numbers, that are held in a private facility. So that's either a federal private facility or a private facility operated by one of the 29 states that operate those types of state prisons. So it's about 8% of the total prison population. Those numbers don't include the number of people that are held in private immigration detention facilities. Those numbers are somewhere around 30,000 people total, with about two-thirds held in private facilities. So the majority of people that are in immigration detention are in a private facility.
And Jeannie Woodford, do you know what the figures are in California in terms of how many California prisoners are in private prisons?
So when I was with the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, we had a cap of in-state of 4,500. And then as a result of the three-judge panel's decision that the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation had to reduce the number of inmates being held in California prisons, the state contracted with prisons out of state to house inmates in excess of the cap. And that number has been coming down, but I believe there's still a couple thousand or maybe a little bit more that are housed in private prisons in other states. So Shane Bauer, what is the appeal of private prisons for states and local entities? What do they promise?
I mean, the private prison companies, their main arguments for their existence is that they save states money. Generally, they are cheaper, although there was recently a federal study by the Department of Justice that basically showed that the cost is comparable. It's not much, and there are a lot of conflicting studies about this. Some studies say they actually cost more in the end. There are issues like in California where the private prison companies won't take prisoners with serious medical issues. So that cost is essentially offset to the public prison. So it's kind of a hidden, there's a lot of hidden costs like this that when you see the number of how much they're saving, all this isn't really.
I think we should point out also that the people who work in those private prisons often don't get the benefits in terms of retirement and other health services, et cetera, that you get as a public prison employee.
Out.
So that's why when they say something like they save $17 per inmate per day, which is
right.
A statistic that I've seen
yeah.
quite a bit, it's a little fuzzy.
Yeah, and the main way that they save money is through what they pay their staff. So they generally, they're cutting a lot of corners generally, and the staffing is the main cost of running a prison. So when you pay the staff less, it costs less money.
And you know that firsthand from working in a private prison. But before I get to that, I did just want to flesh out a little bit how private prisons get paid. Alicia Santo, is it true that they get paid per inmate they house and also that they have occupancy requirements that they put on states or local governments?
As far as I'm aware, it's a per prisoner, per bed sort of contract in which there are often or have been at least in the past guarantees about what that population is going to remain at. So obviously that can lead to lobbying for certain types of laws that would keep that level the same, such as maybe not reducing mandatory minimums because then you're going to have a more steady population of people or lowering certain criminal penalties. So, that's how they've often been structured.
What happens if governments don't meet the occupancy requirement? What kind of penalty exists, Shinda?
Generally, the contract of the prison I worked at guaranteed 95% occupancy rate, which basically means that if it falls below 95%, the government will pay the rate as if 95% of the prisoners were there.
So essentially taxpayers.
Right, right.
Basically, what you're describing, Alicia Santo, is an industry that then is incentivized to have as many people or the demand for inmates, to keep the demand for inmates high, and to, it sounds like you're saying, fight against laws that would reduce that prison population, such as fighting against reducing mandatory minimums or sentencing reform or leniency and things like that. Jeannie Woodford, you're nodding.
Well, yes, included in their annual report is exactly those statements. Is the threat to them is any changes in sentencing laws that reduces sentences, changes in drug enforcement laws, changes in immigration status would actually affect their bottom line, and that they have to put that in their annual report because they need to let the people who buy their stock know what the risk is. And so any progressive policies is a risk to their bottom line.
And how powerful are they as a lobby?
Well, they're incredibly powerful. They give lots of donations to candidates for office. And there's been lots of stories during the presidential campaign that the private prisons were giving money to Rubio, as an example, and other people who are running for to become the president of the United States. And so their influence is pretty great.
Well, I just wanted to point out, too, though, that actually publicly run prisons also operate on
I think we should make the point, too, that many of the private prison employees and leaders in the administrative management positions came from the public system.
Incentives where, for example, I was a reporter in upstate New York at the Albany Times Union, and during the time I was reporting there, there was a huge effort to close prisons, and private prisons aren't allowed in New York State. But that didn't stop it from being a very difficult thing to try to do. The unions were fighting really hard against it. The politicians, where there's a prison in their backyard, pushed really hard against it. So I just want to point that out, that those types of things exist in public sector prisons too, and the same types of horrific conditions also exist in those prisons.
Which then raises the question, Jeannie Woodford, are state-run institutions better than private prisons?
Well, you know, it absolutely depends on the state, because it's how much you put into your prisons that make the system good or bad, right? And so, you know, I think we're very fortunate here in California to have the governor we have, a governor who cares about public safety, who believes that what we do inside our prisons matters to our communities. And so there is an emphasis on rehabilitation. And I know that you mentioned earlier that you've just been in San Quentin and saw all the many programs that are there. And with our current governor and our legislature, those programs are being put into prisons all over California. So they're a lot better than other states. But it really depends on the public getting involved and interested in what happens inside our prison systems, I think.
Well, as the warden of San Quentin, you are really focused on what you believe should be the mission of prisons, which is a rehabilitative function, correct? So what do the interests of a private prison, what impact do you think they have on the rehabilitative function of prisons?
Well, I think their bottom line is profit. And, you know, I've actually been in some private prisons, and they only do what's in the contract. So if they're contracted to provide certain services, that's all they're going to provide. And they're not looking to improve public policy. They're not looking to evolve the system to make it better for the individuals who are in it, which in turn makes it better for public safety in general. So from my point of view as a public servant, having spent over 30 years in the criminal justice system here in California, I always thought of public safety more broadly. And I always believed that what we did inside our prisons had an impact in our communities. And I also believe
by law, the administrators and owners of private prisons are restricted to what they can do. They're operating under a contract. So if what they're doing is not adequate, then somebody who set up the contract for them, who was a state employee or leader, would be partly responsible, if not almost all responsible, right?
That we needed to follow the science and the data, and that's why I implemented data-driven decision-making in the Department of Corrections through a program called CompStat. And that's what I think public policy should be about, evolving to follow the science of criminal justice. And as a result of California's attitude towards that, we've seen some really vast improvements in our sentencing laws here in the state. As an example, keeping non-serious, non-violent, non-sex offenders out of state prison and keeping them at the local level. We have a lot more to do, but that was a huge, huge step in California towards a better system.
I think also, you know, we shouldn't totally create a dichotomy between the state and the private, because the states run, I mean, the states are contracting these private companies, they're overseeing them, and from what I've seen, a lot of, it's not even an issue of the companies just doing what the contract requires. They don't even do that a lot of the time. And you know, the states don't have much of a means to enforce these contracts. They don't usually write into the – I don't know of an example of them writing into the contract, you know, penalties for contract violation. I mean, they'll say that they can revoke contract, but they don't do that. I mean, they're going to close the prison down. So it's still the responsibility of the state, you know, that these prisons are running this way ultimately.
Well, there was an Inspector General report, a U.S. Inspector General report, that basically found that in private prisons that there was a higher rate of assault on prison staff and between inmates. And you were in a prison. You were in the Wynn Correctional Facility in Louisiana. It was a medium security prison for 4 months as a guard.
Yeah.
So
did that play out in your experience? Were they unsafe?
They did.
He did an observation study, but I wouldn't credit him with having a lot of experience as a corrections officer. We did 4 months.
Yeah, the prison I was in was very violent. There were stabbings every week. I'd witnessed stabbings. And, you know, there's stabbings in all prisons. I mean, there's violence in all prisons. But when I left and looked at the data, you know, there was a lot, not just more violence, but more use of force. And it kind of comes down to the issue that, you know, it was way understaffed, for one. There were very, very minimal education programs. A lot of times they didn't get to go outside.
And sorry, when you say understaffed, what was the ratio of guards to inmates?
I would come in to work and there would be days there were 25 guards to 1,500 inmates. So I worked in a unit with 350 prisoners with one other guard. And we didn't, you know, we just have radios. I mean, it's like we're not really doing much. And so, you know, for all and the medicals, you know, is a lot worse. So all of this stuff adds up to this kind of sense of frustration, you know, for people living there. And they're basically living in a dorm of 44 men all day long. And, you know, so people fight. Fights break out. There's a lot of drugs and contraband in the prison. Guards who make $9 an hour try to make ends meet by selling drugs, you know. And on top of that, you know, when I was there, I was, you know, noting whenever there was a stabbing, I would, you know, write it down, the date and stuff like that. When I left, I checked with the Department of Corrections to see how many the company had reported. They're required to report all of them. And it was something like in a two-month period, I had witnessed or knew about 10 or so, and in a 10-month period, they reported 5. So, you know, and this is kind of...
They weren't all being recorded.
Right. And, you know, as journalists, we look for these documents, but if the people writing the documents are lying, they're worthless, and we can't know that, you know, unless we're there.
So just a few things in what you were saying. Part of the reason that the staffing level is so low is why?
Because it's a $9 an hour job. So,
you got paid $9 an hour to be a prison guard.
Yeah, and I was in a very poor town in Louisiana. I mean, really run down. And
so
but still,
provider?
Yeah, well, but still, even though it was so poor, there were not a lot of people willing to work there for $9 an hour. So a lot of the people that did work there, a big chunk of them were single moms that, you know, needed insurance for their kids, needed a job. The job paid like 50 cents more than McDonald's and Walmart. You know, so
this was a prison run by Core
Civic, yeah.
CCA.
Yeah.
So, but what you're saying is that they paid you very little and kept staffing levels low to maximize their profits?
Yeah, well, so the prison itself, they wanted to hire more people, but they don't get to set the pay. That's all done in the corporate office in Nashville. So, you know, it kind of creates this culture where everybody who works there is frustrated with the corporation. I mean, everyone I met other than like the top level staff, inmates and staff hated the company. You know, they just felt like they're just all being used in some way so that these people that they never meet can make money.
I wonder what the escape rate is like. The idea is to keep them behind bars and to keep them safe.
Warden was trying to get a raise. There was a $1 raise while I was there. It went up to 10. You know, but people come in and the turnover is so great because people just say it's not worth it. I mean, it's such a dangerous job. And
well, give an example.
That turnover rate's high in public corrections also. At least it was the last time I checked.
I mean, what did you have to do on a $9 an hour wage?
So we worked 12-hour shifts.
The scariest thing that happened to you, too, I'm curious.
I mean, we worked 12-hour shifts. Sometimes those turned into, you know, 14, 16-hour shifts because there weren't enough people to work, or we'd come in extra days. And, you know, my job was basically to work in a unit and deal with the 350 prisoners, which means let them out to eat, let them back in, lock them up. When they need something, they call for me, and then I have to, like, you know, tell whoever it is. And we are supposed to count them multiple times a day. So we and we're also supposed to every half hour just go through these dorms and just check on people. But no, that didn't happen. Nobody did that. And, you know, so there's this kind of...
You mean they didn't actually follow through with the...
No. I mean, the thing is, they're making $9 an hour. They're not going to get fired unless they do something really, really egregious. So, you know, the attitude is kind of like, there's no incentive to kind of to do this work. And, you know, you're just going to get the prisoners annoyed with you. So it's like, why bother? And then, you know, they'll write it down in the book that it was done, you know. So the auditors will come, they'll look at the book, the books are in order, you know, so it kind of just perpetuates.
Is, Alicia Santo, is what Jane Bauer is describing a unique experience? Do you think it's fairly representative of what happens in private prisons?
It's hard to say. I unfortunately didn't have the experience Shane had. It's hard to say, really. I mean, I would guess it's probably quite typical. I mean, when we wrote about prison transport companies, it's similar in the...
How would she know that? I don't think you have the highest incentive among many public corrections officers either. They don't last long because they don't like the job, although there are nice benefits with it. It's a very difficult job, and you have to want to do it from your heart to help those people and to work with them and to keep them secure. And to keep us secure.
The sense that people are severely underpaid, people are taking these jobs out of desperation, they're pushed really, really far to their limits, and a lot of really bad things happen, but as you report more and more, you kind of have a sympathy for everybody involved, the people working and the people being held in custody.
Yeah, so talk about prison transportation. You know, what is it and why is it privatized, and why is that so, you know, appealing to states?
Yeah, so let's say that you live in Florida and you fell behind on your child support in Ohio, for example, and the district attorney wants to bring you back to face a charge on that. To go and get you all the way in Florida and bring you back would be quite a large venture that somebody that works for the law enforcement department would have to go to. So instead, they contract it out to a private company that does it for a very, very low rate. And the way that it works is these companies, they drive all around the country. They zigzag all across picking up people. Sometimes they drive for weeks on end and nobody gets out of that van except to go to the bathroom the entire time. So that leads to, not surprisingly, really, really horrible things happening to people, medical crisis, sexual assault, multiple deaths. And the guards are driving. They hardly ever get to stop. So they're very tired. We documented over 50 crashes, 12 of them where people died. We saw that there were many times women were held right next to men, even though under federal regulations they're supposed to be separate. So many escapes. We found at least 60 escapes since 2000. 18 of those people went on to commit new crimes. So if you don't feel sympathy for the people in the van, maybe it would concern you that people are getting out and then committing new crime once they escape the van. So it was a big undertaking to figure this all out, because unlike private prisons, which you can see and you know they exist, they drive across state lines, which makes it really hard to find.
Wouldn't the states that employ these private travelers do something about it?
Fine. To really pin who's liable, is it the place that for the pickup, is it the company itself? I mean, interestingly, like Shane was saying, I mean, the people who are the government agencies that hire these companies, well, they're not saying that we want any sort of standard about how these people are brought back to our custody. So sure, they hire the cheapest company, and then the company does it the cheapest way possible, and nobody's at fault for it. It's similar in a lot of ways.
Can you describe one of the suspicious deaths on these transport vehicles?
Yeah. One of the people we wrote about, his name is Stephen Gallick. He's a father of three. He's owned a home remodeling business. He succumbed to an opiate addiction for some time, and he fell behind on child support payments. That was why I brought him up as an example of the kind of person that might end up on a van. And he was on the van, and
so he was arrested for not paying child support.
That's right. Yeah. And he died under mysterious circumstances in the sense that there are multiple inmates on the van that said that he died from a beating that was from the two guards driving the van and other people that were being held on the van. But the medical examiner came back with an inconclusive autopsy, and they're currently, I believe the litigation's ongoing, but he was one of our main stories because we had so much detail about what had happened. We knew we could figure out the entire route, and you just see how they just crisscrossed like all over. And he had been begging for help for quite a long time before he actually died.
And there were multiple people you wrote about who would say they were experiencing stomach pains or some kind of medical issue, but the people who were driving the vans would not, thought that they were faking it a lot of times.
Sometimes.
Concerned about
or,
that,
or there was one woman, Denise Isaac. She was a woman in her 40s, also a mother, who had been complaining for a long time about having, she was kind of, basically a lot of people are on medications and they get put on the van and then their medication is stopped. So it's not uncommon that people start having like a lot of medical distress while they're on the van. So, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing where in that case, the guards actually wanted to bring her to the hospital. Under their company policy, they have to call and ask for permission to bring the person to the hospital. And the company said no. So they kept driving. And we talked to, I did this story with my coworker, Eli Hager. It took us 8 months, two full-time reporters, to figure all of this out. But that's just to say that's how it, much resources it can take to figure this information out. And these two guards that we finally found them, and they were really upset, actually, that this had happened, that they didn't want it to happen. I mean, you could say, like, they should have just went to a hospital anyway. And that would be a valid argument. But the way that some people, we talked to over 50 people that work for these companies. It's just it's people in desperate situations a lot of time taking a job that pays like $8 or $9 an hour to drive for 2 weeks on end. I mean, no one would want to do that.
And they're discouraged from using hotels because they have to pay out of pocket a lot of times for that. Though there's been some reform of that, I guess, but
well, supposedly. I mean, the biggest obstacle is that they have to find a jail to bring all the people on the van to, and they're not going to pay the jail, so they need a jail to volunteer to take all of their people, which isn't
hard
easy
to come
to
by.
Do.
It sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
And what kind of training do these drivers receive?
Well, they've said they've beefed up their training, so we'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say maybe they have. But at the time, we were hearing from people who were saying that, you know, they had, like, anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks.
When you described your training as a private prison guard, you wrote about being tear gassed as part of it. Can you describe your training and why you were tear gassed?
Yeah, I mean, people often bring up the tear gassing thing, which I actually think is one of the more reasonable things I've said in training because the idea is that, you know, if tear gas is used, they want you to know what it's like so you don't freak out in that the first time you're experiencing it is like you're inside a prison.
What was it like?
It's awful. It feels like you're gonna die. Like
and you're supposed to not freak out.
yeah. But a lot of the training was like watching videotapes and we had like maybe 2 days of physical, you know, self defense kind of training. But there were a lot of days that we just sat there and there were no instructors. So we literally just sit all day long and it's a day of training, you know, it counts as a day. So, cause we have 4 weeks, you know, or most days there would be like maybe 2 hours and the rest of the time we just kind of sit around.
So did you feel equipped to handle?
No. I mean, everybody kind of, you start in a job and then the guards are kind of like, well, now you're going to learn how to actually do this, you know, because like, you're not going to, if you sometimes a new guard will come in and try to follow the rules and you can't, you know, you just don't have enough people to do that. You literally can't do all the things you're supposed to do. So you have to make do, you know, which often means that you end up having to use prisoners kind of supplements, you know, to get, like, there was one prisoner we would let out of his dorm. So he could kind of like go to the dorms and see what other prisoners need. And, you know, he would get kickbacks from them, like potato chips or something. And it just made our lives easier.
Just because you were so short-staffed.
Right. And this is something that I was just following what the other guards are doing. I wasn't like initiating this. But I wanted to also mention with the medical stuff, just some of the things I thought.
Yeah.
This really similar issue in the private prisons because medical is, it costs a lot of money, you know. And so if an inmate has a serious condition that the prison infirmary can't take care of, they have to send them out. And by the contract at this prison, the company had to pay that cost. So they were very reluctant to do that, you know, to send prisoners out because it's a huge cost. They're making $30-some a day per inmate and thousands of dollars for the hospital. So there's one man that I met who had gangrene, and he was making repeated complaints. He was going to the infirmary over and over, and this is all, you know, in his records that I reviewed. And they were just telling him that he was lying and, you know, giving him some Motrin and sending him back. And it wasn't until he couldn't sleep anymore, so he's sitting upright in a chair, and the other inmates in his dorm got really mad at him and said that they were going to beat him up if he, you know, didn't go to sleep. So there was a conflict that erupted, and from that he got taken to the hospital and had his legs amputated. So, you know, I met him, and he had no fingers or legs. You know, these stories are just, there's so many. I mean, I met so many people in those situations. People who had heart failure that would go to the infirmary and just get put back on the dorm that was, you know, just kept coming up and they weren't getting taken to the hospital.
You also wrote about how corrections officers or guards experience much higher rates of job-related stress.
I think we're going to cut it off there. And we need to know more about what these corrections officers do, not to overlook them. I mean, to oversight them and second and triple guess them, that type of thing, because it's a very difficult job. And I can tell you that there are people who start on the bottom as a corrections officer with a very decent heart and a good brain, and they work their way up through the prison system and become a top-level person. That hasn't just happened in Ohio. Our former longest-serving state prison director in Ohio, Dr. Reginald Wilkinson, served 13 years, also happens to be African-American, and he was an outstanding prison director, and now he's on the Board of Trustees at Tiffin University in Tiffin, Ohio. And I was the one that nominated him for that. He was very helpful in saying that he would do that. But it's a tough job. And I know police officers, not one, more than one, who actually go in their days off and work in prisons and help people, or go to probation officers' departments and do the same kind of thing. Now, that's the heart. That's the kind of people we need in all of our social services, not somebody that's just interested in a paycheck. Okay, so that's it. That's it for the night. I think what we're going to do is ask Vera Lynn to sign us off, as she usually does, and we'll see you next week.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song.